to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I talked to Evan Ferrari, who is the executive director of Emerge Guelph, an environmental consultancy. It's hard to think of someone in Guelph more knowledgeable than Ferrari when it comes to finding everyday solutions that the average person can make in order to have an impact on climate action. And we turn to him and his expertise again to ask this question. How are we doing? The city of Guelph has two goals, one to be a net zero community by 2050 and the other to be 100% powered by renewable energy at that same time. And while 2050 is still a good 26 years away, it's going to get here sooner than we think. And we're going to think about that. A climate action report card is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now let's leave the letter grade aside and just talk. From the moment Guelph City Council established their net zero and 100% renewable goals in 2021, Ferrari and other community climate activists began asking to see a plan. And they also asked the city to set some interim goals as well. Nothing fancy, but if the goal was to get to 100% by 2050, just tell us when we'll hit 25 or 50 or 75. It shouldn't be that hard, right? Guelph has ridden a reputation for being one of the most environmentally friendly cities in Canada, but the devil's in the details, and that's where Ferrari and others wanted City Hall to do better. This is about more than bike lanes and electric vehicles, too, we should add. There's also the matter of logistics. On the net zero side of things, the actual corporation of the city of Guelph only generates about 3% of the Royal City's total carbon footprint, which means 97% comes from the rest of us. City Hall has been trying to help us out with things like the Guelph Greener Homes program, which offers interest-free loans to homeowners in order to make environmentally friendly renovations, but that's only going to help about 600 households. Guelph has 55,000. And what about our big commercial buildings, plazas, malls, and factories? How are we incentivizing a transition to green tech there? But then, this week, a new controversy arose. The Ontario government is preparing to override a decision of the Ontario Energy Board to discontinue the raising of natural gas rates from Enbridge customers as a way of subsidizing growth in new housing developments, essentially using their existing customers to subsidize the installation of new natural gas infrastructure to create new customers. Well, with all this on the table, it seemed like a good time to invite Evan Ferrari to the show and chat on this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast. He will tell us about the current state of Guelph's conversion to net zero, how he helped successfully advocate for those interim targets, and how he's not sure that the city is still completely focused on the prize as they would have us believe. He's also going to talk about how climate action is getting lost in the affordability and housing crises and why people in marginalized communities and poor people are actually the ones that need climate action the most. And finally, we will talk about the hiccups in the shift to EVs, the new politics of the Ontario Energy Board, and how the climate deniers have changed the game with their new talking points. And one last thing, we did have some tech issues there at the end of the interview, so you don't get my usual sign-off in the end. What can I say? We've all seen a lot of issues with the internet lately, some of us more than others. But there you go. So I caught up with Evan Ferrari earlier this week via Zoom. Okay, Evan Ferrari, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let me start by taking, I guess, a kind of more zoomed out look at the issue, which is something that's been sort of occurring to me lately. Is we have the affordability crisis, the housing crisis, and then we have the climate crisis. And I'm wondering, from your point of view as someone who's, you know, on the ground fighting for, you know, action on the climate crisis, is those affordability pieces, are they kind of overshadowing the broader climate piece right now? Is, like, are you fighting upstream against those kind of headwinds?
If you're talking from a political standpoint, I mean, small p, I'm not talking partisan politics here, but political standpoint, there's no question that that's taking an awful lot of the attention away from climate change. But as far as affordability is concerned, climate change has a lot to do with affordability as well. And needless to say that the opportunity that we have to be able to use our resources significantly more efficiently means that we can wind up having much smaller bills. There's that whole affordability side of this that I'm afraid is being lost in the shuffle here. There's no question that some of the larger utilities are working hard on trying to do stuff with this, and to some degree that the governments are doing it, or at least the federal government is doing it. But affordability and climate change are hand in hand. The other part about climate change is the less we do about climate change, the more it's going to cost us in the long run, from all of the implications of climate change. And inevitably, what happens with climate change is that the most vulnerable and those at the bottom of the socioeconomic scale will be the ones that will be feeling it the hardest. There's no question about that. So there's a real intersection there. But getting back to the gist of your question, there's no doubt that that issue is pushing a lot of, or has pushed a lot of stuff off of the media table, let's put it that way.
And I would agree, those of us in the media do have trouble walking and chewing gum at the same time. Part of this, though, I'm sure you've probably thought about this, is from the messaging side, and like, how do you sell that point that you could be paying more for this later? That's no flood mitigation efforts. Now, I mean, this is kind of getting into the capital P partisan politics of this, but when you have conservation authorities being taken like further and further away from the planning tables, well, the whole point of conservation authorities is was flood mitigation, and there's definitely a message missing here that this isn't like the environment, flood control, climate action aren't political issues. They are very real problems that are going to come for us sooner or later.
They are. And I mean, if I could sort of be the armchair political analyst on this, is that I mean, politicians tend to deal with things that are front and center right in front of them. And climate change, I mean, there's no question for about a 2 week period last summer when people could go outside and had a hard time breathing that it was front and center on politicians' minds. So I think some and the impacts of climate change will be, more extreme weather situations, and they happen sporadically. But when they happen, they're devastating. But let me you mentioned the communication side of things, and I got to say that it's gotten really difficult, especially over the last year and a half. And we've done a deep dive on this, and we've looked at a lot of research that researchers across the country have done on looking at the communications of climate change, as well as stuff in the States. And what's happened over the last year and a half is that, number one, there's been a change in the narrative. Change in the narrative from the standpoint that it's the other side of the equation. The people that are trying to prevent us from going forward, it used to be climate change doesn't exist. Now what it is, well, the solutions really aren't the best. Which is a really interesting approach, because when someone is a definite no, so now what they're doing is that they're wrestling people into the discussion of the nuances of what's the best option to go forward. But what we noticed, this was quite profound leading up to the COP, to the COP climate change conference in Dubai, for about a month. And then as you got closer to it, the anti-climate change information that was out there, the misinformation that was out there, just kept escalating and escalating. And then what we found was remarkable was a huge volume of anti-EV stories out there. Now, that's not saying I'm just talking about the CBC. Like, they just massive volumes of it. And what was evident was that there's been a huge amount of money that's gone into the misinformation campaign, and also lobbying mainstream media folks, to get them, and all they have to do is ask the question, well, what about the batteries? And then there's a story about somebody that had a hard time of batteries or what have you. But the interesting thing was that it was leading up to the federal government announcing their two targets for electric vehicles. One was 20% all EV sales by 2026, and the other one was 2035 had to be 100%. So I'm using it not to go down the EV rabbit hole, so to speak, but the volume just it really went. It went over the top, and then we started taking a look and looking at again what the researchers saying is that you don't I don't have to convince you that climate change doesn't exist. I just need to put fear, uncertainty, and doubt in your mind. And if I've been successful at doing that, then I've probably moved you to a point of inaction. Well, what the hell can I do anyways? So why should I bother? Which is a very interesting communication strategy because it works well. People say, well, I don't know what to do because I don't know about the batteries. Well, there are good answers to all of these things. So that the communication side of this has been really difficult. I've got to say it's been because it's very well funded, extremely well funded by us. And they make no bones about it. The oil and gas industry has hired Hill and Knowlton, and Hill and Knowlton, one of the largest PR firms in the world, were the same ones that brought us the lies about cancer for 40 years in the tobacco industry. So they're using similar methodology to it, which just I'm amazed at how well it works. But yeah, I know we're not talking about city politics here, but
No, we're not.
it's evident in everything that we see, right?
No, but I mean it's all kind of a piece, right? You were talking about people who are marginalized, people who don't, have a great lot of means, people who are directly afforded by affordability. And I know one of the things that is sort of keeping people from investing in electric vehicles is the fact that there's no real secondary market for it yet. I mean, we're getting there, but in terms of used cars, it's probably easier to find a gas-guzzling car on the used market than it is an
Well,
EV.
you know what? There are half a dozen of them in Guelph on the market today. I go to Auto Trader, and I'm going to interrupt just for a second there and say that they do exist. I know people that have spent as little as $16,000 on a used EV and are doing just fine by it. And what we've suggested to people, if you're serious about an EV, you don't have a good enough choice here. Go to Auto Trader and put in a downtown Montreal address, and you'll get three times the volume that you would if you're looking in the Toronto area because they've had rebates for a longer period of time, and they've been really aggressive with it. So they are out there, but there's no question that it's more difficult than going to a couple of three places in Guelph and picking something up. But I mean
And
that's one of the issues. There's no question. There are issues.
the other piece of that too, though, is that EVs have been subject of a lot of, skepticism and I don't know if it's been a formal campaign for years, but I mean, the whole thing about, well, how far can you go on an EV battery? That's been like the barrier for a lot of people for years to getting an EV.
Well, they call it range anxiety. And talk to anyone that has an EV, and like 98% of them will tell you that it's the first thing that dissipates. Because the average Canadian drives less than 50 kilometers a day. All those vehicles can travel at least 50 kilometers on a full charge. The other thing is, you don't have to go to a gas station anymore. You come home, you plug in, you don't even think about it. Then you turn around and you leave and you drive away with it. And of course, everyone says, well, two times a year I go to my friend's cottage and I'm going a longer distance. That it's how do I do this? Well, guess what? There's no fewer than six different apps that tell you where all the charging stations are. They also tell you whether they're being used or whether they're in service or whether they're out of service. So there's a phenomenal network of things out there that are reasonable questions for people to ask, but the repetitive nature of the questions makes people think that, well, this is stupid. Why would I want to do that? But it's indicative of what economists call disruptive technologies. And disruptive technologies are everything from the wheel to the telephone to smartphones and computers. In each one of those things, what happens is that it goes through a market acceptance on a bell curve. Except most new product adoption happens on a standard bell curve, except for disruptive technologies. What happens with them, it's the initial early adopters that are going to jump into it. And these early adopters have the money, they're environmentally motivated. Even if they don't have the money, they're motivated sufficiently and they're technically adept. But
Right.
what happens just after that, before it gets into the majority, is there's something called the chasm, where all these crazy questions come up because people don't know the answers to them. And it's funny that I've looked at those acceptance the market acceptance charts for all sorts of different disruptive technologies, and it just blows me away. It happens every time. So we're approaching the chasm right now. And for all the reasons that people ask those questions, those are reasonable responses, but they're being repeated so frequently that it's making that chasm deeper. And when we
Right.
get, but we've already passed the point of no return. In can in with disruptive technologies, once you hit 10% of market share, which it has in Canada, it's game over. The math is exponential, and you're growing by 20, 25 to 35% a year. And what will happen is people will blink and go, "What happened? How come they're everywhere now?"
Right.
In a short period of time. So there's no doubt in my mind that we'll hit that 20% mark by 2026, unless something catastrophic happens. The trajectory that it's currently on, it's going to be easy, and 100% probably by just after 2030. Forget about the 2035 target.
Yeah.
This stuff is moving.
And the market, I mean, it's the like the car companies themselves are moving it, and so they have the market research to say this is where this is going, that they don't need the government push. Well, that probably helps, but
But I have to admit, of late, the legacy automakers, the ones that we all know historically, the gas manufacturers, are pulling back. And one of the reasons that they're pulling back and they're trying to switch to plug-in hybrids instead. And one of the reasons that they're doing that is because disruptive technologies disrupt the economics, the environment, and society. The economics for them change. The legacy automakers make more of their money on you bringing your car back for service, and
Parts, yeah.
all that stuff. So a gas car has 2,000 parts, an electric car has 20. So you don't need to be a mechanical engineer to think, well, maybe it's going to be a little cheaper to be able to run this thing. And I think a number of them are really running scared. So if they sell you a plug-in hybrid instead, which unfortunately extends the use of gas vehicles, but if they sell you that ex in instead, now they have to maintain two different systems for you.
Right.
So, and that's part of the disruption. What do you mean? Our business has been doing this for 120 years, and now you're wiping it out? So a lot of this disruption happens in places that we never thought of, and I can't imagine what's going to happen to small ma and pa garages.
Yeah.
Like, there'll come a time when they won't be doing much, or they'll have to be switching to something else. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean that's the shame of it, but I mean how many ma and pa garages are out there right now too? That's
Yeah, there
the
aren't a
other
lot.
thing.
You're right.
Yeah. Well, speaking of disruption, let's talk about City Hall. but I know that one of your windmills is trying to get some interim targets out of City Council in terms of reaching our net zero goals and our 100% renewable goals. So how is that going right now?
So we got it. We got what
Okay.
we wanted.
All right.
So we got what we wanted. Essentially, what we were looking for was we wanted to have interim targets outside of the only other target we had was 2030. This sounds really absurd, but we wanted an interim target for 2026. And what was concerning about it is that the target is almost irrelevant, Adam. The issue here was that they were ignoring it. They were just ignoring all of this. So we had some immediate targets, but Nothing until 2030. So they finally came out with this 2026 number. For almost 2 years, the deputy chief administrative officer told me that they were going to be coming out with interim targets. And I said, what's the holdup? All you do is you get a spreadsheet and it's a straight line. If this is where you're trying to be, I wasn't even suggesting what that target should be. Just do it. It took them over 2 years from the time that they committed to it. And so putting it aside, the issue for us was they don't care, and there's no leadership at City Hall, bureaucratically or politically, to actually move the things forward. We had a stellar community energy initiative in Guelph that communities across the country have taken and improved on radically, and then we ignored it. And we've continued to ignore it. So besides sort of nipping away around the edges, what did the city do? It got rid of our Energy Guelph that was mandated to do an awful lot of this work, and really have done nothing on the inside other than bring the money into the building that they would have gone to our Energy Guelph. But they brought the money into the building, and they're really not looking at the broader community. They're really only spending time on two things: the operations of the city, which are important. And the city has a 100% renewable energy target, which is stronger than community-wide. But the city's only 3% of the entire city and of the entire community. So what are they doing with the entire community? They're doing things like, they're ramping up cycling infrastructure, which is good, but we are way behind other communities like Waterloo Region, like the City of Toronto, like Ottawa, like Victoria. I mean, there's a lot of hullabaloo about it, but it needs to happen faster. That's a tiny, tiny piece of the puzzle. The other thing that the city, I know that you wanted to talk about as well, was talking about is the Greener Homes program, which is a good idea. However, at the current rate, it will take 75 years to get the work done. So what the city has said is that we have money for 600 homes. There are 55,000 households in Guelph. And do the math on it. My understanding is that as of last time I saw numbers was when I was talking to the city recently, and it was around 330 households that they had in the queue. That doesn't mean they've loaned the money out. It's just they've got it takes it's a process that takes up to a year for people to get through the process of doing the work in their home. But they've got a cap of 600 homes. When that's done, there isn't really a lot of discussion of what happens at that point. And the residential portion is only one small part. What's the city doing on the ICI end of it? The institutional, the commercial, and the industrial side of things. And on the transportation side of things, it's great that we've got electric buses coming, that's coming on an as-needed basis. But you more than any are so familiar with the lack of good service when it comes to Guelph transit side of things, that we need to really up our game there. So what's happened essentially is that they've abdicated responsibility for the community energy initiative that we've had out there. And now what we're doing is whack-a-mole. Whack-a-mole from the standpoint is, okay, we need to push them on this and then maybe they'll do it. And then we need to push them on this and maybe they'll do it. But the city had committed to all this stuff. And like the thing that we've been concerned with for some time, and now we're starting to push about, is green development standards. And this goes to the transportation piece, that we need to build our newer communities in such a way that you don't need to drive everywhere, that you don't need to, or and you, we also need to build those places so that they're more accessible from a public transit standpoint. So this holistic approach has been thrown out the window. There's just no desire. If anything, it seems to be the other direction.
Well, and to get to your point, 55,000 homes in Guelph, and when you said that, it's like, well, that's the number we have right now because we have this mandate to get another 18,000 units. Now that's not just households, that's, you know, apartments and things, but the 18,000, there's no mandate to make those net zero or 100% renewable or to use green
Correct.
builds. And I mean, a lot of that is like building code and standards and other things, but we could just be creating another 18,000 units we have to retrofit later, right?
You're bang on. Now, granted, they would be better than homes that were built in the 70s and the 80s and the early 90s, but marginally, right? And
Marginally.
when your point about the building code is the worst possible environmental standard for building homes that you can legally build in Ontario.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
I mean, I just don't know what else to say about that. So the concept of green building standards, we're so far behind on this. Municipalities, like all the municipalities involved with Waterloo Region, believe it or not, tonight in the Wellington Museum between Fergus and Elora, tonight Wellington County will have their first open house on the green development. Wellington County is ahead of us, for God's sakes. Dufferin is ahead of us. Grey is ahead of us. Mississauga is ahead of us. Toronto, Ottawa. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And we've been asleep at the switch. There's been no discussion about this. And that concept of green development standards, while I'd like it to be mandatory, what it does is it provides developers that, and we do have some developers that are doing some good stuff in the city. Where they are building net zero homes, or they're trying to, and they're running into all sorts of problems with it. But what green development standards would develop is they would have standards not only around the building envelope, how energy efficient the house is, but also around the water consumption, also about natural attenuation of water on around the building. It'll deal with tree cover. They deal with everything related to, dare I use the term, green. I mean, I know it's overused, but
Yeah.
it's meant to be that holistic approach. So, if we're two developers and I could care less about this stuff and you're interested in it, you could go to the green development standards, and usually what municipalities have is monetary or non-monetary incentives that you would use because you're going to be doing this stuff anyways, and you want to use it as a market differentiation against me because I just want to build, the worst possible homes I could make to make the best profit out of it. Whereas you're seeing benefit, larger benefits that you could sell with the homes that you build.
I guess then what's kind of the what would it take to sort of galvanize all of these aspects? Because as just as you're talking, I was thinking all the planning meetings I've sat in where the developer gets up and some counselor usually it's one of the Ward 5 counselors. I won't name her, but if you pay attention to city council, you know who she'll ask it, like, what about green build? What about net zero? And the developer, usually the answer starts with, well,
Yes, exactly.
so, you know, I understand because there's been this little hobgoblin in the minds of a lot of people in town called the Guelph Factor. You don't want to be, quote unquote, throwing up barriers. But as you were kind of, you know, talking about this is the direction other municipalities are going in, and at some point, someone is going to like formalize these standards, whether that's, you know, the province or the feds, or whether that's just because every municipality is going to have the same kind of green standards. So I guess like just what is holding us back? We have a council, we have a, you know, every press release that's about even anything remotely environmental says Guelph, we're one of the most environmentally friendly cities in the country. And just
Shine is
that's,
off. That's been obliterated.
So I guess just like what's kind of where's the wall and how can we knock it down?
Political desire to do it.
Okay.
That's it in a nutshell. I'll give you an example of some stuff. London, there's a 200 acre development that's a live work play that's 100% renewable energy. And it's halfway built right now. Ottawa has a similar, that place is called West 5. The place in Ottawa is called Zibi. That's very close to being very similarly built with all doing all the right things. Locally, TerraView Homes, they have two different net zero energy, net zero builds going on, one south of Courtright and the other one off of Aramasa Road. So imagine that, and there are other builders, like Reed's Heritage Homes actually built the first net zero homes in the city. Actually, you could see them. The Sikh Gurdwara down on Clare Road.
Sure.
If you're that way, if you're out that way, just go into the parking lot behind it and look to the houses that back onto it. There are five in a row with solar panels on it. Every one of those houses is net zero, but they didn't build many more than that at the end of the day. So what green development standards would do is it would allow developers that are willing to go the extra step to be able to use that as a shiny badge. Or there are these non-monetary, I'm not completely up to speed on it, but there are non-monetary incentives that the city could provide to give them a leg up over the other developers. And it's political will. Tiny township, not tiny township, sorry, King Township, a township of 23,000 people has a green development standard. Tell me we don't have the capacity to do this kind of stuff. This is strictly about small p and capital P politics. And I say that from the standpoint that there is little leadership on council and in the senior bureaucracy, but the senior bureaucracy takes their marching orders from council. So if there isn't a lot of really good leadership on a specific item, they're not going to do it. There's no advantage for them to do it.
I also think, and this isn't a knock against staff, city staff necessarily, but they also want to take the path of least resistance.
You know what? And that's their job.
Yeah.
That is their job. They, you know, the city council creates the policy and tells them what to do, and they do it.
Right.
At times, they may give advice contrary to what council may want, but in the end, they have to do what council has to do, says or doesn't, by the same token. So I see any of the environmental. Let me back up and say, let's look at all the environmental positive things that have happened in the city. One of them is the whole naturalization stuff that's gone on since the late 70s, early 80s. That started with community action. It gurgled up from community action. It got to a point where it became institutionalized. And I don't mean that in a negative sense, but I mean, and there are still great organizations out there doing a lot of tree planting and habitat restoration, but it became institutionalized. And what that said was society wants this. Then the
Right.
next thing was waste management. The first thing with waste management was a family that had bins at the parking lot next to the lawn bowling area.
That's
And people
right.
would bring in their own stuff and they'd have to put them in the different bins, and it gurgled up from the bottom. The wet dry wasn't city council or the consultants' ideas. It came from the community.
That's
And
right.
then it was entrenched, it's institutionalized. Water conservation, exactly the same thing. It's from a water conservation and waste management perspective, we've got some pretty stellar numbers because it got to a point where we were doing best practices and it got institutionalized. Climate change, we were getting there, and we came to a halt, with the exception of doing things that are good, but by no way are they going to get us to where we need to get to.
What's the role of the developer here? Because I mean, you've been citing developers who are trying to make that shift,
Yeah.
but I mean, that's not a whole industry effort because
No,
of
it's not.
various
No.
reasons.
Yeah, and I must say that there's a role of so green development standards have been developed in a vacuum of provincial oversight on it and provincial leadership on it. There was an attempt at one point of the provincial government to attempt to shut them down, and they've kind of backed off on it. It's not mandatory. inevitably this stuff starts by being not mandatory. I mean, the tobacco ban in bars, for God's sakes. You know, some bars started doing it just because they thought it was the right thing, and they were sticking their necks out, and they were getting abused about it. And no doubt, and they were getting abused by probably their colleagues because they said, "Oh, once you start, we can't go back." And I know that to some extent that's probably happening in the development end of it. So it's got to gurgle from the bottom up. I mean, provincially, they even took some things out of the building code because they wanted to make a point. And that happened a few years ago now. But yeah, it should be building code, but it's not. We have the technology. We know how to do this stuff. The political will doesn't exist. So green development standards, yeah, that's a really good opportunity for us to move down that path. By the same token, institutions like the University of Guelph has done some incredible things, and they are reinvesting the money that they've saved from a lot of the stuff that a lot of specifically around energy efficiency and conservation, and constantly reinvesting it because it you get the law of diminishing returns, so things cost more to get more reductions out of it. So they're doing some wonderful things up there that, and they've just blown us out of the water compared to where the city's at with it all.
All right, before we wrap up, I want to address this motion that's, I mean, by the time this goes to air, the motion will have been heard and probably
Yes.
adopted. But this controversy around the Ontario Energy Board passing this, was it a motion from the
Was a
OEB?
decision.
It
It
was a
was a
decision,
decision.
okay.
So they made a decision. Yeah.
To stop developers from, or to stop Enbridge from being able to tag taxpayers with the cost of hooking up the natural gas infrastructure in new developments. And
Right.
the Ontario government is currently working on legislation or working through legislation to undo that decision.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. First of all, has that ever happened before? Like the provincial government has done overridden an Ontario Energy Board decision?
Yeah, I was when I initially went looking, I was told no, and then someone sent me an email. I haven't been able to ground truth it from Waterloo somewhere that and said that it had happened once before, quite some time ago. So I don't know the answer to that. I'm going to make a friendly amendment to your description of it all.
Okay.
It's not that Enbridge wanted the taxpayers, but the gas anyone that pays gas.
Okay.
So it's a which is. From a residential standpoint, like 85% of all residences are gas heated or have gas in their building. So anyone there would be paying for this. And here's the interesting thing with that is that we have been paying for it up
Right.
until now, and the OEB did an assessment on it, and the Ontario Energy Board is an arm's length organization whose job it is to act on our behalf and in our and to benefit the people of Ontario. And they looked at it and said, this makes absolutely no sense. The cost of gas is only going to increase, number one. The implications of climate change are such that people are switching off of gas quicker than you can imagine. So what happens is the fewer gas customers that are out there now, they're going to have to spread the cost of these new pipelines
Right.
to a smaller and smaller group of people. And guess who can't afford to spend the money to put heat pumps or do all the other work around homes or people that can least afford it. So
Right.
it's a bit of a downward spiral on that. So they were really bold in doing this, but it was a proper assessment of where we needed to go. And instead, the government said, no, we're going to support the developers on this. They claim, I
Right.
love this, but they claim that this is about affordability and
Right.
this is about making a new house more affordable for someone. So they want to make everyone else pay for the possibility of someone saving, I think it's somewhere around $4,000 per new home. In a typical suburban, I mean, in apartment buildings, it's obviously less. The economies of scale are there, but
Yeah.
so somewhere around $4,000, and the letter that the motion that's going to council tomorrow or on the 26th, rather, yes, correct, the 26th,
Tomorrow, yeah.
That it essentially says that hopefully that the city of Guelph supports the Ontario Energy Board's decision and feel that it would be inappropriate to go ahead with the bill that's going to be that's before about to be introduced into the legislature that would reverse the decision. And that's I mean that's really problematic when the, yeah.
I guess, the politics of this seem even more messed up than they usually do because, you're for most people when they move into somewhere and it's hooked up with natural gas, they're not going to go, well, first thing I'm going to do is unhook all this natural. They're going to use the natural gas for their heating, for their stove and whatever. So you're imposing something on people that they don't really have a choice for. The other thing is, making something more expensive for other people to make something cheaper for supposedly cheaper. Because I mean, there's no guarantee that costs on new homes, the cost savings on new homes are going to be passed down to people who are buying those homes either. Plus, you also have this market tinkering, with the we have regulators. The province is coming in and putting its thumb on the scale for a company. I guess the big question is, like, politically, it's falling on the backs of the municipalities to try and adjust the province on this. I guess who's winning here, and why are we being forced to have this fight?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I guess my response to that is that, we'll attempt to put pressure where we can to get the job done. And it seems that this is sort of the place we could have the most impact. Places like Vancouver and Toronto and Ottawa have been really successful with this stuff. Toronto's been at it since 2017. Oddly enough, we brought in a city councillor from Toronto in 2017 to speak about this very issue and had some really actually that was Mike Layton when he was still a city councillor. He was very much involved with with this stuff. There's no reason why we can't go ahead and do this. Cities around the world are at the forefront, regardless of what their subnational or national governments are doing on things, that they're really taking the bull by the horns because that's the level of government that touch all of us more frequently than any of the others. It's in our face, the garbage, the roads, the libraries. To some extent, all the social services and everything are essentially delivered by the city. So, it's the logical place for us to apply pressure on this one.
And I think I get that, but and maybe we'll wrap up here, but we have an Ontario government right now that is not exactly embracing I mean, whether that's firefighting in the north, whether that's
Uh-oh, is that me again?
no, it's I can hear you.
Okay. All right.
Okay,
Sorry.
no, that's okay. Whether it's firefighting in the north, building code, whatever it is, and then we're looking at the federal level and right now, and there is at least a government right now that accepts climate change is real and it needs action, but that's good. That's far from a certainty as we're heading into an election next year. We can keep that pressure on the municipal council, but I mean, would it not be easier if we had all three paddles in the boat paddling in the same direction?
Big time, big time, big time, big time. I always try to remind myself that the second largest group of lobbyists at Queen's Park is the gas industry. The largest is the nuclear industry.
Wow.
So if you want to look at recent decisions, that's about as far as you have to go to try to understand it. And I will say that all of those lobbyists, they lobby all of the different parties. They don't just lobby the parties in power.
Right.
And federally, the largest isn't the is the oil and gas industry. So the pressures on them are phenomenal. I mean, we subsidize oil and gas to a very large extent through a whole myriad of different things. This isn't even about taxing them. It's about just taking away some of those subsidies, which make it all better for all of us.
And once again, that was Evan Ferrari. You can learn more about the advocacy and services of Emerge at their website, emergeguelph.ca. That is EmergeGuelph.ca. Or you can follow them on the socials at Emerge Guelph on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You can learn more about the City of Guelph's Greener Homes program at the city's website under the Living section, and you can also find a direct link in the show notes for this episode. And to learn more about the natural gas decision of the Ontario Energy Board and how council got involved this week, you can catch all that meeting coverage over on Guelph Politico proper. And that is it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. You can download the Guelph Politicast every Wednesday from Apple, Google, TuneIn, and Spotify. And when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you'll get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. You can follow Guelph Politico on social media. We're at Guelph Politico on Twitter and at Politico Guelph on Facebook. You can follow me personally at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter and Instagram, or send me an email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com if you'd like to help financially support the work of Guelph Politico. You can get all that information at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And finally, for all the latest local political news, you can check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of this show for you here next week. And until then, see you next time.